Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
Then-President Clinton wanted to go to North Korea and continue dialogue and discussions, and the incoming Bush administration, essentially forbade him from doing that.
Eric Lever of the Institute for Policy Studies is our guest this time. He's a research fellow with the Peace and Studies Program and serves as the outreach coordinator for the Foreign Policy in Focus Project. That's the Institute for Policy Studies, ips-dc.org, and fpif.org, Foreign Policy in Focus. Eric Lever will be filling us in on events having to do with North Korea and the Middle East, Iraq policy, and more. First, these updates on North Korea. The Pyongyang government preempted U.S. TV coverage of the 4th of July launching of the space shuttle by launching a new class of missiles, including the Taepodong long-range rocket. U.S. networks have been subtle in their coverage of this threat, in sharp contrast to coverage of other threats reported since the War on Terror began. The White House and press spokesperson Tony Snow have been restrained in their language and have downplayed the threat posed by this latest gesture from Kim Jong-il. And even the usually bellicose John Bolton at the United Nations said, quote, "We think we can proceed in a calm and strong and unanimous signal from the Security Council," according to Dana Milbank of The Washington Post. The tests broke a moratorium on all missile testing declared by Kim Jong-il in 1999. And according to John Pfeffer of Foreign Policy in Focus, that decision was a carrot the North Korean leader hoped might lead to a deal with the Bush administration and other countries, but it was rebuked. The Bush administration has tended to reject proposals for any negotiations that would not involve China and Japan, a decision that's frustrated policy analysts for years. They've wondered why the president would not allow Pyongyang to follow through on discussions with U.S. officials about various offers to disarm. In fact, during the 2004 presidential debates, Democratic candidate John Kerry said he would enter into bilateral talks with the North if elected. The president said this would undermine his plans for talks that included six parties: China, North Korea, South Korea, Russia, Japan, and the U.S. Bush also reminded the audience of his infamous Axis of Evil speech before Congress, saying, quote, "There's an axis of evil, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, and we're paying attention to it, and we're making progress." On July 6th, South Korean officials said the North had three or four more missiles on launch pads. Japan said it did not appear that any of them were long-range missiles. Japan has imposed sanctions on its own. China and Russia are continuing to urge diplomacy, and the UN Security Council is considering what it will do. Eric Lever of IPS and Foreign Policy in Focus, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
Let me ask you about, first of all, where things stand with IPS and their research into what's going on in Iraq. Are you able to get immediate information from the region?
We probably have no better access than most journalists do. I have, and many of my colleagues here have, contacts inside Iraq, and so we're able to talk with people on the ground, both Iraqis and Westerners who were there observing the situation. And by all accounts, from both Western observers and Iraqi observers, people keep feeling that the situation is getting worse instead of better, and that the U.S. occupation continues to fuel the fire on the ground. It's clear that more and more people are trying to leave Iraq, that the situation there, especially for refugees, is getting worse. And when you look at statistics from the Iraq Body Count or Iraq Coalition's casualty count, that 2006 is actually the worst year of conflict so far, barring the initial invasion. But it's yet, even as Iraq is seeping deeper into conflict, we continue to see a lot of inaction on the U.S. front, other than policy prescriptions aimed at staying the course.
We're seeing lately more stories about civilian casualties, and tensions just couldn't be higher right now after the reports of March events where U.S. soldiers apparently raped and then shot an Iraqi woman and killed the entire family, as well as this young woman.
The civilian casualties have been increasing. It's very clear from looking at the numbers. It hasn't exponentially increase. So, you know, what we've seen are gradual increases, which indicates that while tensions are getting higher, fighting is continuing, we're still not sort of at the point of kind of the civil war that everybody's talked about. It's more the stakes are increasing on all sides. And, you know, the U.S. actions only continue to feed that. You know, as we've seen incident after incident after incident of U.S. Abuse inside the country, that's clearly feeding the fire of the insurgency, not just against the U.S., but it also, you know, continues to fuel tensions between the different sectarian groups that are there on the ground.
Even as there were calls for Donald Rumsfeld's resignation, the talk turned to the death of Zarqawi and, you know, the U.S. military scrambling and spokespersons struggling to try to portray a success story in Iraq yet again. Just talk about where we've come since that juncture where Zarqawi was killed.
Well, the killing of Zarqawi clearly was, you know, a success for the U.S., and you know, he was responsible for a lot of violent death inside the country, especially, you know, adding to fuel the civil conflict that's going on there. But, you know, focusing solely on Zarqawi, just as focusing on other leaders in the deck of 52 cards, you know, didn't produce any sort of results, especially as we see the cells operating, you know, the terrorist cells operating so independently from one another that, you know, killing one individual, while it's great for making headlines, is not sufficient to change the situation on the ground. The operational tempo for the insurgent groups, you know, continues unabated. And, you know, what was not really reported was, you know, the lack of intelligence that the U.S. really had. I mean, most of what they were acting on, the intelligence was from the Jordanians. And so, again, even after, you know, 4 years, the U.S. isn't any closer to understanding the insurgency or the dynamics that are really going on in the country, that they're dependent on regional players, you know, people who actually know the country, can speak the language, can understand the customs. And so, you know, we're continually going to be dependent on that, and shows, you know, just a weakness that we have in fighting the counterinsurgency battle.
Now, the United States has been talking about the western part of Iraq for some time. There were bombing runs up the Euphrates River, and now there's more discussion about what happened in Haditha, where U.S. soldiers apparently engaging in a massacre. Just talk about the policy involved in the bombings and then bringing in ground forces into these regions, some of those forces having just been in Fallujah, where we know that there was a lot of fighting, but we also know that roughly 60% of the city was destroyed. Do you get the sense that there's a kind of a taking off of the gloves once again, as Rumsfeld once said about torture?
The campaign of shock and awe, you know, began in the precursor to war, before the war actually began, and it's been, you know, Rumsfeld's line and the president's line ever since then. You know, just as long as we can hit them hard enough, they won't be able to respond, and then we will, quote unquote, you know, win this war against terror. But in every case, from Tal Afar to Fallujah, that these sorts of activities both have very little value in terms of, you know, militarily improving the situation or politically changing the situation on the ground. So instead of reducing the number of insurgents, they actually serve to increase the numbers, or at least keep them being able to replenish their ranks at the same levels and numbers. In addition, you know, they continue, every attack like that continues to alienate the U.S. from the Iraqi general population. So again, this whole notion of winning hearts and minds takes a step backwards every time the U.S. engages in one of these sorts of runs. So again, it's extremely counterproductive, and really shows the lack of the U.S. military to adapt and to change to the situation on the ground.
There's so much going on politically in the United States, and attentions will now certainly be turning to North Korea, more discussions about security as the November elections approach. But has the Institute for Policy Studies been working on any kinds of reports about what can be done to foster peace, to foster a U.S. troop withdrawal, and so on?
Through our Foreign Policy and Focus project here at the Institute, which I work on, we just released a report last week in anticipation of another showdown with North Korea. In it, you know, we talk about the fact that the U.S. really does need to come to the negotiating table. North Korea is a classic example of the U.S.'s failure to engage in diplomacy. Starting from day one, right after Bush was elected, then-President Clinton wanted to go to North Korea and continue dialogue and discussions, and the incoming Bush administration, you know, essentially forbade him from doing that. And so, as we see now, you know, some 6 odd years later, we're in a precarious situation where we don't have good lines of communication, and we're dealing with a regime that has a lot of animosity towards the U.S., but also is using essentially the only tools that it has on its side to try to engage the rest of the world. Unfortunately, those tools that they have now really are only military. And in part, it's been prophesized by the U.S., I mean, by saying that they're a member of the Axis of Evil and really ignoring them, you know, when they try to ask for negotiations or any other sort of discussions other than military. So now, as we see in Iran, you know, we've seen the same thing before in North Korea, that the only tools that they have to play on the table are military ones, because those are the only ones that the U.S. has any respect or acknowledges.
Now, the U.S. press, in reaction to the launching of these 7 missiles by North Korea, has been interesting to watch. And I did notice that Pennsylvania's Republican representative, who has been to North Korea, Kurt Walden, told CNN, actually, that North Korea had asked him to come back again some 3 months ago, and that the White House had told him not to go because they anticipated this missile launch. Talk about how strange it all seems, with various political analysts hoping that the Bush administration will agree ultimately to these bilateral talks that North Korea wants, and the White House saying, no, we want the 6-party talks.
The U.S. And the administration continues to want to have all of the tools for foreign policy decision making in its court, so that they've been, you know, just as they have discouraged any debate and discourse in the Congress on Iraq, so too have we seen that same sort of approach for North Korea. So it's not surprising that they're asking even people from their own party not to jump in. You know, I think that we need more discussion, more of these sorts of openings bilaterally to help improve relations on both sides and understanding on both sides. And, you know, when we get to the point of demonizing every regime that we don't like, it becomes increasingly harder to break down the walls that get built up between these societies and lead us to, you know, these sort of the very types of military standoffs that we hope and work to avoid.
How does all of this work, do you think, in terms of the Democrats versus the Republicans? Who will be able to most effectively argue that they can solve the problems now with North Korea?
Well, it's tough to figure out how all this plays out in the election cycle. Clearly, you know, the Republicans and underneath Karl Rove continue to try to play the fear card at every opportunity that they have. The Democrats have consistently tried to illustrate that there's another alternative, there's another approach that's possible. And as you have fractures within the Republicans, as we've seen growing on the Iraq issue, as well as Iran, as well as North Korea, it theoretically should play into the hands of the Democrats. That said, the Democrats have not been very forthcoming with offering alternatives of their own because they've been afraid of what the general reaction would be. And my reaction to that is, you know, here we are, our nation's at a crisis point in history. Now is the time for bold and new and innovative ideas. It's time to try to change the course, not just through rhetoric, but through sound policy prescriptions. And so as Congress is ready for their break over August, one could hope that they don't spend too much time sitting at home electioneering, but actually trying to figure out some solutions to these problems. And that's the sort of thing that I think that the voters will reward, especially as, you know, we continue to see elections decided by name-calling and public image instead of, you know, the battle over ideas and visions for our country.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. It's interesting, Eric Lever, when you look at Congress now, it's so fractured between the House and the Senate. We have two different bills on immigration being discussed, and where we just saw a bill passed in the House on the Palestinians, and it was the Palestinian Anti-Terror Act. We spoke with Stephen Zunes about that, and he explained that there is a relatively small group, but a very vocal and very powerful group in the U.S., led primarily by AIPAC, which has been really resistant to any of the possible solutions for what is going on in the Middle East ever since the election that brought Hamas to power. And so right now we see a standoff with the Israelis militarizing, moving in on Gaza, looking as though they're going to engage in some horrific policies. We're not hearing of civilian deaths, but we're seeing rocket attacks, and we're hearing very terrified people clamoring for an end to this, the Christian Science Monitor calling for calm, and nothing from the White House in terms of all of this. Do you get the sense that across the board in the Middle East and in terms of North Korea, that the White House is really cloistered and listening once again to a very small group of militants?
They've been listening, I think, to a little bit wider range than they had been before. You know, having Condi Rice over at the State Department, I think, has opened up a few new avenues. But again, we're still seeing and hearing the same sort of policy prescriptions over and over again, which means that despite the facts that we've seen, a disaster in pretty much every area of foreign policy, that, again, the administration isn't willing to sort of rethink its roles. And, you know, nowhere is that more evident than in the Israeli-Palestinian situation. I mean, the fact that there's a much larger war that's now being waged over the abduction of one soldier really does show that the crisis of diplomacy, not just between the U.S. and other places in the world, but the example that we have set and now helps lend itself to escalation of situations as we're seeing in the Gaza Strip right now.
Do you think that the rhetoric in starting back with that axis of evil speech really set the tone and that there's no moving away from it?
It is indeed very difficult to move away from that sort of speech when you've laid down the line so clearly and have shown consistently throughout the administration that they've been unwilling to back down. Again, I think that that's the biggest failure of this administration, is the failure to learn from its mistakes. And so trying to figure out how you change the course with only 2 years left in this administration is very troublesome.
Now, Donald Rumsfeld also called for regime change in North Korea. And many people have pointed out that a lot of what Hamas has done is a response to some of Israel's tactics and calls for regime change in terms of the Palestinian government, Rumsfeld calling for regime change in North Korea. How much of what's going on is a reaction to President George W. Bush in the White House? And do you anticipate that we can make it through the last portion of this term?
Well, I do, you know, have hope that we can make it through the next 2 years. Again, it seems that as the administration becomes more politicized with its message, there are voices within the Republican Party that understand that those sorts of policies are detrimental to, you know, the vital security interests of the United States. And so, you know, we hope that smart policy prevails over political pandering and maneuvering for, you know, essentially political office. That said, there hasn't been a lot of hope. You know, the voices in opposition to the president have been relatively small within the Republican Party, and folks have been very marginalized. That said, I think that the American people have a hope that, you know, Democrats can change the course. And so what very well could be a political sea change in Washington, with, you know, having the Senate and or the House switch over to the Democrats would make it much more difficult for the president to continue engaging in these sorts of behaviors, activities, and policies that are proving to be so detrimental not only to the people here in the U.S., but to folks across the world.
I just want to turn to a paragraph from an article by John Pfeffer at Foreign Policy in Focus, part of the IRC organization. He says, "Nothing clarifies politics so much as a rash act. North Korea's launch preparations, real, pretend, or something in between, have illuminated the difficult corner into which the Bush administration has painted itself. The proposals to attack preemptively, given the well-known and horrific consequences of such actions, reveal how impatient even previously moderate voices have become, with not only Kim Jong-il, but with George W. Bush as well." Just talk about your organization a little bit and the role that you hope to play in providing this kind of political analysis.
Sure. Well, you know, unlike many other think tanks in Washington, both the Institute for Policy Studies and the Foreign Policy and Focus Project, you know, seek to try to provide information to social movements, to the peace movement, to the anti-corporate globalization movement, et cetera, et cetera. And so by providing this sort of analysis and really trying to get at what some of the underlying issues are, which between the U.S. and North Korea have far more to do with the political situation rather than a military crisis. And we both hope to inform the grassroots so that they can be better informed as they do organizing or working with Congress or engaging in the media. And just as we hope to provide that sort of tool for the grassroots, we also employ that here. We work with policymakers. In fact, I had conversations with a few staffers this morning wondering how to respond to the North Korea situation, as well as doing media interviews and doing the vital writing and research that's so important for us as a movement.
Now, there are a lot of topics that I'm sure will be covered in the coming weeks as North Korea is more in the news, those being the economics, the geopolitics, the technologies that involve satellites that is mentioned in John Pfeffer's piece. But again, looking at this from the point of view of why the White House is committed, married, if you will, to these six-party talks, why the dependency, if you will, on China's involvement?
I think, you know, the part of China's involvement deals with the larger political picture that the U.S. is facing today and in the future. You know, China is supposed to essentially be our biggest competitor, both in the economic sense and in the military sense. And so being able to bring them in, I think, is actually important. As much as I'd like to see bilateral talks be happening, I think, you know, it's important for us to realize the value in bringing together all of the regional players as well. You know, China has specific interests at hand, as well as Japan, and clearly South Korea has been one of the more positive players as the whole situation unfolds. I mean, they have the most to win or lose in the situation. And so, you know, engaging on a multi-party level is important, even as very real bilateral issues remain for the U.S. and North Korea.
Let's end where a lot of people might be beginning, which is with Japan. Japan and South Korea having imposed economic penalties on North Korea today. Let's just mention those two countries, really.
As much as it's a political situation in between the U.S. and North Korea, it very much is a security situation for those two countries. I mean, they're the ones, you know, very clearly North Korea isn't going to launch a missile to hit or attack the U.S., but, you know, much as in the Cold War, these states are seen, you know, more and more as proxy states for the U.S., and so their reaction in dealing with the missile launches is rightly seen as a very real security threat, despite whatever, you know, political situation surrounds the event.
And the White House has been calling for calm. To what extent are they, do you think, calm? I mean, are they relying on the policies they've set in motion and hoping that their new positioning in the world in different locations might be the answer to security in terms of the international picture?
You know, the U.S. has been drawing down some forces in that region, mostly to be moving them to Iraq or being able to help alleviate some of the problems that they've had within the military due to, you know, sending so many forces to Iraq. So what militarily the U.S. can do in this situation. You know, it's just about has its hands tied as much as North Korea does on the diplomatic front. And that the U.S., by using such strong rhetoric, as you had quoted John Pfeffer saying, really does limit the amount of options that the U.S. can take. That, in fact, I think is why it's so important for this issue being brought up at the U.N. or within other multilateral forums, because that's the only way that the U.S. can, you know, really be seen as having a way out of this dangerous situation.
And we keep going back to the U.N., just as the White House wound up going back to the U.N. after discrediting the U.N. and working against the U.N. at the early stages of the invasion of Iraq. George W. Bush wound up going to the U.N. with hat in hand looking for help when security was breaking down drastically in Iraq. Just talk about the U.S. relationship with the U.N. now and perhaps after the November election. Do you think things might change, or do you think the course has been set and John Bolton intends to stay it?
Well, John Bolton, I believe, was given a recess appointment, and so there'll have to be a whole other series of discussions about his tenure there, and I don't want to speculate what's going to happen with that, although clearly, you know, there's been a lot of tension at the U.N., you know, over his appointment. You know, it's not to say that the U.N. doesn't have, you know, its problems. Which means that it's collectively the world's problems, and nobody's been working very hard to try to solve those problems. Instead, we have, you know, especially here in the U.S., hear a lot of rhetoric, you know, blaming the U.N. for failing to implement its reforms. Well, you know, the U.S. is the largest stakeholder. It does have a big role to play in that, and when you're continually denouncing the role of the organization, it's hard to see how one promotes real change and reform in that sort of tone. So, you know, in that sense, you know, thinking about what the future of the relationship is, it's hard to think about how it changes underneath this administration, although it's clear that for, you know, collective security, for being able to engage in a forum where people actually sit across the table from one another, that sort of dialogue and interaction is needed more today than perhaps at any other time.
Eric Lever with the Institute for Policy Studies, thanks so much for taking our call and joining us on Talk Nation Radio.
And thanks for having me.
Eric Lever of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's research fellow with the Peace and Security Program and serves as the Policy Outreach Director for the Foreign Policy in Focus Project at IPS. The websites are ips-dc.org and fpif.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced at WHUS Stores, radio for the people at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNation.org for transcripts and discussion. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m.